little bit more about what you all get interested in. So wait, let me just get people in via Zoom, and you can pass these around. These are sonnets. So let's just wait a second to see if, like, the five people who said they were gonna zoom in. Okay, here's one. Yay, here's two. Here's three. Wow. Not bad. Here's four. Hi. Hi, everyone. Okay, so I don't know if you got it yet, but I sent the handout that I'm distributing today. I also sent it out on Latte. So if you want it, I mean, you should have gotten it, but you may not have checked your email yet. So you may want to do that. I can put it on the screen, but that's gonna be too awkward just going back and forth. So why don't you go to your email and get the handout for today, which is what we'll be talking about. And I am going to, I don't know, do you want to see me or the room? You want to see the room. Here you go. There. Do you want to be seen? Maybe you don't. okay, here is a, oh, well, if I write anything on the board, now you'll be able to see it. Okay, maybe this works. Okay, hope you all feel better soon. All right, so what you have in front of you are sonnets. And so having looked at the form of the heroic couplet, the way Pope uses it, and also having looked at blank verse, that is without rhymes, here are several sonnets from Wyatt. Remember, he did the long Love That In My Thought Doth Harbor that we talked about on Thursday. And he is the person who introduced the sonnet into English. So the sonnet became a very popular form historically from the time of Wyatt in English to now. If you look at the sonnets that are on this little handout, they go from Wyatt to Terence Hayes. There could be a lot more, but Terence Hayes is fairly contemporary. Like his book, do people know who he is? So he has a book of sonnets, all of which are called American Sonnets from My Past and Future Assassins. And that is the title of each sonnet. So this is one of the sonnets from that book. So we're going to look at some of these sonnets. And part of the idea here is to look at a very popular form of poetry. Can you pass this to Eliza? Oh, thank you. So you don't need to pass it to Elijah, but thank you. A very popular form of poetry that allows for a lot of different variations. So this is by no means the whole spectrum of variations that sonnets can be written in. They mainly rhyme, sonnets do, but they don't always. So the question is, well, one question you can ask yourself is, what makes something a sonnet? Is 14 lines enough to make something a sonnet, or does there have to be some other aspect to a sonnet or to a 14-line poem that will make it a sonnet? We won't open this can of worms except just peek into it just for a tiny second, which is there are sonnets that are not 14 lines long. Most famously, there's a sonnet sequence by George Meredith called Modern Love, where the sonnets are 16 lines long. And Milton has a couple of sonnets that are considerably longer than 14 lines. So what that means is, defining a sonnet, there may be some blurring at the edges, but generally the definition of a sonnet is that it's a 14-line poem that rhymes. And as I say, it won't always be 14 lines, it won't always rhyme. But when it does rhyme, as you'll see in most of the sonnets that we are looking at, the rhyme scheme will have an effect on how the sonnet works, on, you could call it, the distribution of ideas in a sonnet. So one of the things we've been talking about a lot is the relationship of formal aspects of a poem, like meter, rhyme, layout, and so on, to the meaningful aspects of a poem, whereby, or meaningful is the wrong word, because forms can be meaningful too, but to the signifying language of a poem, to what the poem would sound like, read like, if you read it in prose. That is, poems in general use the same language, not quite, but pretty much the same language as prose. Not quite, because there's all sorts of poetic license. An example that you will all know is 30 days hath, when you're trying to remember how many,
September.
Yeah, what other months?
And
what about the rest?
All the rest, 31.
Oh, yeah, what about February?
It's all alone.
Okay. Which?
28 days.
And?
Year 29.
Okay. So not a great rhyme, alone and nine, but it's a rhyme. But you wouldn't, if someone says it's October, I can't remember if Halloween, which I know is the last day of October, is on the 30th or the 31st, and you were telling them that October had 31 days, you wouldn't say, well, you know, 30 days hath September, because you wouldn't say hath, and you wouldn't put it in that order. You might say September has 30 days, so do April, June, and November. And then you'd say all the rest have 31. So that would be the same in poetry and prose. But you probably wouldn't say, save for February alone. You would say, except for February, which has 28, and leap year's 29. So half of it could be standard prose. Half of it is going to do some poeticizing of language, which is to say the kinds of things that you will do in a poem that poetry has taught us, that songs have taught us, that it's okay to do to spontaneous speech in order to fit that kind of speech, that kind of signifying, that kind of sentence uttering into a poetic form. So we will accept in poetic form, we will accept some unusual word ordering, word orders that you would ordinarily not find in prose, and that will allow you sometimes to get from a snatch of language, from just a fragment of language. You know, let's say you're an archaeologist in 1,000 years, and you find one of the things that I did on this handout, as you'll see on the second page, is there is a photograph of a sonnet by Elizabeth Bishop. It may be less legible than I wanted it to be. But this is a sonnet that she wrote in college, and we will take a look at it. If you want the more legible version, I sent it out on Latte. She never published it in her lifetime, and then someone found it and it was published in her Actually, I tell a lie. She did publish it, but as something she wasn't happy with. But when poets are not happy with their own poems, that's often a sign that it's a good poem, because they're really invested in that poem. The great French writer Paul Valéry says had a definition of writing poetry where he says, a poem is never finished, it is only abandoned. So at some point, a poet will abandon the poem that they're writing. And sometimes if you feel like you really, really, really are abandoning something, if that sense that you're abandoning it is really strong, it's because you will be so highly invested in it. So the fact that a poet doesn't publish a poem doesn't mean, or the fact that a poet doesn't like a poem doesn't mean that the poem is something that you should necessarily diss. Yeah?
Do sonnets have to be an iambic pentameter?
No.
Okay.
No. There is, I think I quoted this for you, but maybe I didn't. So there's a Shakespeare sonnet which begins, when in the sessions a sweet silent thought I summon up, anyone know? When to the sessions, I'm sorry, it's like law sessions. When to the sessions of sweet silent thought I summon up remembrance of things past. So if you know that title, that's the first English language translation of the title of Proust's great work, better translated as In Search of Lost Time. It's actually what I was giving my really interesting paper on at this conference this weekend that other people thought I should have abandoned. So basically the way that sonnet goes is I'm engaged in sessions of sweet silent thought, and I summon up as though to a court, as though these are court sessions, I summon up remembrance of things past. So in these sessions, I sit as a kind of presiding officer, and I summon up my memories. And then he lists all these things from the past. Is this sonnet familiar to anyone? He lists all these things from the past, all of which depress him, because they're all gone, because everything in the past is gone. And he lists all those things. And then he remembers the guy he loves. And he thinks, so the last couplet of the sonnet is, but if the while I think on you, dear friend, all losses are restored and sorrows end. So I think about all these things that I've lost over the years, and it fills me with sadness. But if I remember you and how much I love you, then I'm happy again. So it's a nice poem. George Starbuck, a late 20th century American poet who has nothing to do with the coffee chain. You know the coffee chain is named after Moby Dick, right? Yeah. There's the first mate on the Pequod. Ahab's first mate is named Starbuck, and that's where they got the name of the coffee shop chain. The second mate is named Duncan. Did you know that? That's a lie, but it would have been great, but it's a lie. But Starbuck comes from Moby Dick. However, there was a great poet named George Starbuck who... someone else is coming in. Okay. Elliot, let me just tell you that if you want the handout for today, I sent it out on email, so you should be able to get it that way. So Starbuck actually screwed up his life in a really interesting way, which is that he was an up-and-coming poet in the 60s and was asked to contribute to an anthology, which he did, wrote a great poem called The Bayou Tapestry, but it turned out that it was also an acrostic, and that if you read the first letters of every line, it was a huge insult to the guy who was putting the anthology together, who was the major anthologist of the time. And what the first letter said, his name was Oscar Williams, was Oscar Williams fills a need. Like the Monkey Ward catalog, it gives us something to read. And what the Monkey Ward catalog is the Montgomery Ward catalog, which used to hang in outhouses, you probably know, and people would read a page, and then when they were done shitting, they would use the page that they just read to wipe their butts. So that's what he said about the guy who was doing the anthology. And it was in press, in print, and then some intern who was looking at the page proof said, "Wait a second." And he told Oscar Williams what Starbucks had done, and Williams hit the roof, and he had lots of power, and he said, "You'll never publish a poem in this country again." Starbuck was like, he's going to be, everyone was thinking of him as the it guy who was coming along, and now he was the no longer it guy. It had a major effect on his life, but he didn't like Oscar Williams, even though Williams was publishing him. So at any rate, Starbuck published a book called Space Saver Sonnets. This is going to your question, are sonnets always an iambic pentameter? He published a book called Space Saver Sonnets, which are several Shakespeare sonnets where in hemimeter, which is to say that each line was a single syllable long. So any two lines made an iamb, but each line was a single syllable long. And they were sonnets, so they were how many syllables each sonnet? 14 syllable sonnets. So they were essentially 1/14 the length of the Shakespeare sonnets that they were paraphrasing. So the one called, the one that begins, "Went to the sessions of sweet silent thought, I summon up remembrance of things past, and then can I mourn a forbemoaned moan." This is all Shakespeare. His version of it is, "To think, loo, dink, and..." Well, first I'll say it just as a sentence. "To think, loo, dink, and Miss Landis dead. You do steady me." So all these people are dead, but then he thinks of the person he's addressing the sonnet to. "You do steady me." But the sonnet goes, "To think, loo, dink," so that's A-B-A-B, "and Miss Landis," C-D-C-D, "dead, you do stead," E-F-F-E, "D-me," G-G. So perfect Shakespearean form, three quatrains followed by a couplet, all in 14 syllables. "To think, loo, dink, and Miss Landis dead, you do steady me." So there is an extreme answer to your question. Do they have to be in iambic pentameter? The answer would be no. A famous sonnet sequence in Russian. Anyone know the most famous sonnet sequence in Russian is Eugene Onegin, which is also an opera, but it's a novel in sonnets by Alexander Pushkin. One of the greatest of all Russian writers. The sonnets are in 8-syllable lines. And there are English imitators, including Vikram Seth, who have also written novels in 8-syllable lines. So they're trochaic. Seth writes in trochaic, iambic trochaic. Lines. Okay. What am I saying? Trochaic tetrameter lines. All right. So there is a Starbuck sonnet in the handout, but let's start with a couple of translations of a sonnet of Petrarch's. As I mentioned before, Petrarch actually invented the sonnet. He's an Italian writer who was the next generation after Dante. And Wyatt is the one who wrote The Long Love, I'm sorry, wrote They Flee From Me, which we talked about last time. And this is his translation of a Petrarch sonnet that his younger friend, Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, also translated. They're both in the book called Tottle's Miscellany, which I mentioned last time. The fuller title of Tottle's Miscellany is Songs and Sonnets by Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, and Other. That is, and other people, the primary other being Wyatt. So at the time, in the mid-16th century, people thought Surrey was the greater poet because smoother and more accurate in his translations. People now basically understand that Wyatt was the greater poet, and Surrey thought Wyatt was the greater poet. So at any rate, Surrey's translation, let's start with that because it's a bit more accurate to Petrarch. Love that doth reign and live within my thought, and built his seat within my captive breast, clad in the arms wherein with me he fought, oft in my face he doth his banner rest. So someone paraphrase that or start paraphrasing that. People on Zoom, you can do it too. You can unmute and just jump in if you want. So, love that doth reign and live within my thought. What does that mean?
Love that rules my, like, my thought patterns, my life, like, it's my brain.
Yeah. And rules is a good word. That's hence the word reign. Love has power, has command within my thought. Good. And built his seat within my captive breast. So what does that mean?
His heart. It's like he feels the love.
Yeah. And what does built his seat mean?
Like sort of wormed its way in there. It's sort of like stuck and comfortable now. It's not getting out anytime soon.
Okay.
It reminds me of like a throne.
Why?
Well, just because like it's built the seats. It just kind of has that like sound to it. And also, I know love reigns.
Yeah.
Thus, it's going to build a seat.
Okay, good. So it's when you talk about a county seat, you're talking about what's essentially the capital of a county. So the word seat here does mean the place of authority. This is, so love is ruling. This is love's authority. Clad in the arms wherein with me he fought, oft in my face he doth his banner rest. So, clad in the arms wherein with me he fought, how did love get to rule?
Fought
against whom?
The man doing the weapon. Fought against his want to not love.
Yeah. So, love defeated me, and therefore rules within my thought, and has built his seat, has taken over, has taken power within my captive breast. And now what love does, clad in the arms wherein with me he fought, so he's still wearing what love is?
Armor.
The armor that he was wearing when he defeated me. Oft in my face he doth his banner rest. What kind of banner?
Victory.
Almost.
Like a war banner.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. What are you going to say?
Well, I don't know if this is correct, but like when it says something like off in my face his banner doth rest, does that mean like he's blushing or whatever?
Yes. So love's banner is blushing. And so love reigns in my thought. I can't get away from it. My breast, my heart is captive. Love is still lording it over me and taking his banner And that's a metaphor for a blush. A blush is the banner of love. Line in Antony and Cleopatra, Cleopatra says to Antony, that blush is Caesar's homager. That is to say, the reason you're blushing is because I'm accusing you of being too frightened of Caesar. And look, you're blushing, and that shows that blush is you're showing homage to Caesar. Yeah?
Is the standard rhyme pattern always going to be A-B-A-B for sonnets?
No. Okay. No. I brought a lot of sonnets with different rhyme patterns. So, good question. This sonnet is actually, at least the first two stanzas, are somewhat unusual because they're more Shakespearean than Petrarchan. So, what does that mean then? It means that he often does what when he sees the person he's in love with? Yeah, so, but that's the point, is that he is describing a situation in which he feels that he's a captive to his own feeling, which he describes as something that comes from outside of himself, that it's love, and that when he sees the person to whom he's of whom he's thinking, he blushes. And how does she respond? But she that taught me love and suffer pain, my doubtful hope, and eke my hot desire with shamefast look to shadow and refrain, her smiling grace converted straight to ire. What does eke mean? Do people know? So this is a word you need to know for pre-1800 English literature. It means also. So eke is just, it's now an archaic word, although you'll occasionally find it, even in modern English, but it means also. So she, who is she?
The person he's in love with.
Yeah, the person he's in love with. She that taught me love and suffer pain. So she's the one who taught me to love and therefore to suffer pain, but also maybe taught me to put those two things together. If you're going to love, you're going to have to suffer pain. Don't just think you can love totally scot-free. If you're going to love, it's going to be with suffering. So she that taught me love and suffer pain taught me as well my doubtful hope. So what would that be?
Hope of having her as his.
Yeah, or anxiety. I hope, but I don't. But I'm very doubtful that what I hope will ever happen. So it's a description of being in love with someone. Not thinking it's going to go anywhere. My doubtful hope and eke my hot desire. So she made me both timid and also turned on simultaneously. So why is he blushing?
Some mixed emotions.
Yeah, and each emotion would make him blush. That is, he's got hot desire for her, but his hopes are doubtful, and so he blushes at his own desire. And the very and you can see that his hopes are doubtful because he's blushing. So how does she respond to his blush? So she that taught me love and suffer pain, who taught me my doubtful hope and eke my hot desire, taught me with shamefast look to shadow and refrain. Taught me that I should look ashamed, that I should shadow and refrain my obvious interest in her. How does she respond when he blushes? How?
Anger.
Her smiling grace converteth straight to ire. Wait, so you're seeing me in blushing again? You know that you're not supposed to be thinking of me the way you're obviously thinking of me when you're blushing like this. So he's in trouble. And so how does love respond? And coward love. So love has pressed straight into his face. But now she gets angry. So coward love then to the heart apace taketh his flight, where he doth lurk and plain. Plain there means complain. So he goes straight to the heart, where he doth lurk and plain, his purpose lost, and dare not show his face. So he's all humiliated, and his love has shriveled up. And then he says, but it's not my fault. For my Lord's guilt, thus faultless bide I pain. So I'm experiencing this pain for love's guilt. It's not me, it's love. For my Lord's guilt, thus faultless bide I pain. Yet from my Lord shall not my foot remove. I'm still going to be faithful to my Lord that is faithful to love. Sweet is the death that taketh end by love. Say it again.
That was a really good poem.
Good, yeah. And so one thing I want us to notice here is that in a sonnet, because you're going to be expanding and extending an idea, lots of metaphors are going to appear in a sonnet. Sonnets advance, but they usually don't advance through a single metaphor. Although here, it kind of does. That is, he has this metaphor, love conquered me, because love conquers
all.
So love conquered me, but so that means he planted his flag in my forehead. But that means that the woman that he wanted to ally with me in order to try to conquer her gets really pissed off, and love conquered me but loses to her. Not that love no longer feels love for her, but love shrivels and shrinks away. But I am going to still be loyal, not to her quite, but to love itself. Because love did conquer me, and I'm going to be faithful to my Lord. So that's kind of interesting. That it's not, she told me to go fuck myself, and I'm going to be faithful to her and not listen to her, because that would be a contradiction. It's rather, it's not my fault, it's love that is making me love you. If I had a choice, I wouldn't. But love has conquered me, and I have to remain faithful to my conqueror. So notice it's making a kind of iffy argument for why he's going to stay in love with her, even if she's telling him, don't be in love with me.
Do we know anything about Petrarch's love life? Like, is this about?
It's about someone named Laura. All his sonnets are about someone named Laura, and whether her name was really Laura or not is unclear. He just wrote so many sonnets to Laura and other kinds of songs to her, and it does give you a kind of novel in verse. You can see things sometimes are good, sometimes they're bad, sometimes she's in a good mood, sometimes she's in a bad mood, and whatever's going on, he has to suck it up. All right, so now let's look at Wyatt's translation of the same sonnet, which is the first sonnet on the page. So, the long love that in my thought doth harbor. So, a much more mysterious line. But harboring in my thought would mean that's where it is taking shelter. And the love is long, maybe like a long ship. Yeah. Okay. And in mine heart doth keep his residence. So that's where, like the residence of King Charles. Windsor Castle. It's in my heart. Into my face presseth with bold pretense, and there encampeth spreading his banner. So notice there that it's the same word, banner. And the idea is the same. It's a little bit harder to follow in Wyatt, but the idea is the same. Wyatt's translation was first. She that me learneth to love and suffer and will that my trust and lust's negligence be reigned by reason, shame and reverence with his hardiness taketh displeasure. So I think you can follow it pretty well because we've done the other version of it. Notice the rhyme scheme is different though. It's, what is it?
ABA.
And then?
ABA.
Yes. So the rhyme scheme, unlike in Surrey, but like in Petrarch, the first eight lines, this is called the octet. Remember we talked about the unevenness of the Petrarchan sonnet, which is that it divides into eight and six, which is to say four pairs of rhymes and then three pairs of rhymes. So the octet rhymes A-B-B-A, A-B-B-A, harbor, residence, pretense, banner. Not a great rhyme, but Wyatt loved those rhymes. And we remember we saw goodness and newfangledness in They Flee From Me as a rhyme. So harbor, residence, pretense, banner, suffer, rhyming with banner and harbor, negligence, reverence, displeasure. So it's worth noticing that the B rhymes are pretty perfect. The A rhymes are fragile. And that's part of Wyatt's effect, is often there'll be great fragility in his lines. Just to remind you again of something that I pointed out on Thursday, Wyatt, when he revised, before he abandoned his poems, when he revised to make them rhyme less well, and he revised to make the meter less regular. He wanted a sense of wildness and a sense of uncertainty in his poems, and he does that through form. So in that sense, he's the opposite of Pope. So the long love, such a beautiful phrase, the long love that in my thought doth harbor all that tentativeness and in my heart doth keep his residence, into my face presseth with bold pretense, and there encampeth spreading his banner, but she's not happy. She that me learneth to love and suffer and will that my trust and lust negligence be reigned by reason, shame, and reverence, with his hardiness taketh displeasure. So what does love do? Coward love then to the heart apace taketh his flight, says Surrey. Wyatt, wherewithal unto the heart's forest he fleeth. So think how much more evocative that is, the heart's forest, wherewithal unto the heart's forest he fleeth, leaving his enterprise with pain and cry, and there him hideth and not appeareth. So love is hiding in the heart's forest. What may I do when my master feareth, but in the field with him to live and die, for good is the life ending faithfully. So one difference again between Wyatt and Surrey is that in Wyatt's poem, in Wyatt's version, Surrey's is more accurate, by the way, to Petrarch, but Wyatt knew that. He wasn't trying to be accurate. In Wyatt's version, it's clear that the speaker is being faithful to love rather than to the woman. In Sari's, it's sweet is the death that taketh end by love, which is to say, even if she kills me, I'm glad to die out of my love for her. So a thing to notice here, we're going through this a little bit fast, but this is introducing something we're going to be doing next in this class, which is talking about metaphors. And sonnets, as I say, inevitably lead you into metaphor. A thing to notice here is that sweet is the death that taketh end by love. No longer is love personified there. Do people see what I mean by that? That is, the line, sweet is the death that taketh end by love. Someone could say that to you and you'd know just what they meant. Die for love? Sure, that would be great. That would be a sweet death if I die for love. But no one is going to think, oh, you're personifying love and you're thinking of love as a military captain who has captured you but has and is ruling your heart, but is not powerful enough to stand up to this woman. If you say, you know, dying for love, that's a sweet way to die, what you're saying is the feeling of love, the abstract idea of love. So at the end of Sari's sonnet, love is no longer metaphorical. Love is no longer the love that doth reign and live within my thought, that is no longer personified, but it's rather, I don't have to personify anymore. I made my point, and now I'll just say it straight out. Sweet is the death that taketh end by love. So love is last personified in the 13th line, but not at the very end. In Wyatt, love is personified throughout. And Wyatt's speaker is faithful to love. For good is the life ending faithfully. He is not going to remove his foot from his master whom he's protecting. What may I do when my master feareth, but in the field with him to live and die? For good is the life ending faithfully. And faithfully is not the same thing as staying in love with this person. It's rather being faithful to his commander. And so he doesn't drop the metaphor at the very end. It's almost as though the metaphor has so taken over him that he is going to be faithful, not to her, but to the idea of love, to love personified. And that's kind of spookier and more interesting. So the reason people used to like Sari better than Wyatt was because Wyatt was spooky and Sari was less spooky. And the reason some people now, like me, prefer Wyatt to Sari is because Wyatt is spooky and Sari is less spooky. So this is a good example of that. So two translations of the same sonnet. Sari's is more accurate, but Wyatt is, I think, will be the one that you will remember longer. Okay, let's look now at a famous sonnet of Shakespeare's, Sonnet 73, which is next on the sheet. Do people know this sonnet? This is one that's often done in high school. Not at all familiar? Okay, so the situation is that we'll call him Shakespeare, the speaker of Shakespeare's sonnets, whom we'll call Shakespeare. How autobiographical they are, they're obviously pretty autobiographical, so little is known of Shakespeare's personal life. I mean, a lot is known, but not at this level of detail, we can't say to what extent they are said in full voice. In the same way that we don't know if Laura existed and what Petrarch actually thought about her, we can't know for sure that the addressees, plural, of Shakespeare's sonnets, there are two addressees that the sonnets, some to one, some to the other, we can't be sure who they are.
another gender?
Yeah. So the first, yeah.
Did you have to, like, address a sonnet to someone? Was that a
no,
thing?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, but it was a thing after Petrarch.
Oh.
That is, that a sonnet was a kind of love poem that you address to someone, but lots of people don't address sonnets to people, but it's kind of, the idea of the form is that it is a strong appeal. And so even if the sonnets are not appealing to a particular person, there will be this sense of appeal. Yeah, so ask again.
Do you know the genders of the people who receive these sonnets?
Yeah, so it is clear that the first 129 sonnets are written to a young man. And then the last sonnets, the last, 27 sonnets or 25, the last two sonnets are iffy, are written to a dark-haired lady. There's some candidates for who they both might be. But they may not really exist. They may be notional. One of the interesting things about the sonnet is that Shakespeare feels betrayed by both of them at various points. And he says, "I can't believe you betrayed me." And in one sonnet, he basically says, "I can't believe you betrayed me with him," namely the young man. And this is to the dark-haired lady. And he's saying to the young man, "I can't believe you betrayed me with her." So there's a kind of knowing hypocrisy there, which is, you're both cheating on me, but if two people are cheating on you, that also means that you must be cheating on them. And that is part of Shakespeare's point. But here, this is addressed to the young man. And he is considerably older than the young man. And he represents himself that way in the sonnets. It's a lot of the sonnets. Oh, just to tell you, one of the early sonnets is he complains before he's fully open about his queer desire that the young man is just so good looking. And nature obviously intended to make you a woman because you're just so gorgeous. But then nature herself must have fallen in love with you. So she pricked you out for women's pleasure, which is too bad for me, but she really wanted to have sex with you, so she pricked you out for women's pleasure. You know, it's just think how much fun we could have if only you were a woman. So that's a very strong hint that he's giving the young man. She added, as he puts it, she added one thing to my purpose, nothing. The idea was that the official meaning of that is she added something to you which isn't really helpful to me, pricking you out for women's pleasure. And the word prick meant what the word prick still means. But also to my purpose, nothing means, but it doesn't bother me. In other words, it's officially means sure doesn't help me because I really wish you were a woman, but it unofficially means totally fine that she added this one thing. As far as I'm concerned, there's no problem with it. So that's his very strong hint in one of the earlier sonnets. So here he is addressing the young man and he says, that time of year... Oh, I'm sorry, there's one other thing that I wanted to point out about the Petrarchan sonnets before we get to this, which is that Petrarchan sonnets, as I said before, they do have this 8 and 6 structure. And what usually happens between lines 8 and line 9 is that the sonnet changes direction. That is, so in the Wyatt/Surrey translations, love rebuked goes fleeing into the heart's forest. So the first 8 lines are how love is pushing forward and interested in her, But she gets angry and takes displeasure, and then love does something else. Wherewithal unto the heart's forest he fleeth, or, and coward love, then to the heart apace taketh his flight. So that's called a volta, or turn. Like a revolt is to turn against those you are revolting against. So that turn in classically occurs between line 8 and 9. That's what you expect in a Petrarchan sonnet. Shakespearean sonnets are written in three quatrains plus a couple. And the quatrains will often give you parallel examples of the same thing. And the movement from stanza to stanza when you have three quatrains and then a couple is one where the real volta, or the official turn, occurs in the last couplet. So that, for example, in let me just read you the whole of the sonnet that I mentioned before. Actually, I'll read you both. So this is the one that George Starbuck did the 14-syllable version of. When to the sessions of sweet silent thought I summon up remembrance of things past, I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes new wail my dear time's waste. Then can I drown an eye unused to flow for precious friends hid in death's dateless night, and weep afresh love's long since cancelled woe, and moan the expense of many a vanished sight. Then can I grieve at grievances foregone, and heavily from woe to woe tell o'er the sad account of four bemoaned moan, which I knew pay as if not paid before. So when I summon up all of these thoughts, then I sigh and I drown my eyes and I weep afresh and I grieve and I count up this sad account of four bemoaned moan, which I knew pay as if not paid before. So those are the three quatrains. Just to tell you the rhyme scheme, it's thought, past, sought, waste, which for Shakespeare rhymed perfectly. Flow, night, woe, sight. Foregone, tell o'er, moan, rhyming with foregone, and before. Those are the three quatrains. And then we get the couplet. But if the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored and sorrows end. So the volta, the switch in direction, occurs in the last two lines. Then I think of you and you do steady me. So one thing that's a little bit off about Starbuck's version is it's not the last two lines. You do steady me is five lines long, but can't be perfect if you only have one syllable per line. But you have three stanzas of how sad he is. That's 12 lines. And then change in the couplet, but then I think of you and I'm no longer sad. All losses are restored and sorrows end. Just to read you this other one. A woman's face with nature's own hand painted hast thou, the master mistress of my passion. A woman's gentle heart, but not acquainted with shifting changes as false woman's fashion. So everything good about women, nothing bad about women. An eye more bright than theirs, less false, enrolling, gilding the object whereupon it gazeth. A man in hue, all hues in his controlling, which steals men's eyes and women's souls amazeth. So those are... that's everything about the young man. And for a woman wert thou first created, till nature as she wrought thee fell a-doting, and by addition me of thee defeated. So she added something which defeated me, since I was so attracted to you, by adding one thing to my purpose, nothing. And then we get to the couplet. But since she pricked thee out for women's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy love's use their treasure. So at least let me have your love. Even if women get to use you sexually, with that thing that was added to you, they get to use that. And but I at least get your love. So this is a strong hint. But again, notice that in the couplet, he's saying, okay, I understand, sleep with women, do that heterosexual thing, because we're all heterosexual here, right? But as long as you love me. And after that, he stops hinting, and they start having sex. So here's a later sonnet to the young man, in which he expresses apparent gratitude towards the young man. That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. So what's the metaphor here?
Could it be like love? Just like the bare bough, like that used to have, you know, birds singing on it. I love and loving, and now it's just like ruined and cold.
Okay, why that time of year, though? What does it mean to say you can behold that time of year in me? So what time of year is he describing?
Like fall. The fall and winter.
Yeah, so you can see. It's later fall than we're at, but this is pre-climate change. So you can look at me and you see a certain time of year, which is, it is the autumn of my life. So that time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none or few do hang. Why do you think he says, or none or few? Why that ordering? It's so Shakespearean, and it's a subtle and great thing that he's doing here.
To highlight how few?
How does it highlight how few?
Well, at first my mind pictures something like zero, and then it's like, well, maybe there's like one or two.
Yeah, so the gestalt, the first impression you get is there are no leaves. And then you look a little closer, and yeah, there are a few leaves there. And it does highlight how few. That's exactly right. If it were few or none, it's just going to be, okay, yeah, few or even none. And he's made his point. But or none or few, is something Shakespeare does a lot, that kind of effect. And it really gives you a visual sense that few or none would not. When yellow leaves, okay, or none, so far, either they're yellow leaves or they're none, or few. And now, yeah, there are a few leaves, they're yellow, maybe brown. It's hard to say because there are really almost none left. Or few do hang upon those boughs that shake against the cold. Why are the boughs shaking?
Wind.
Yeah. So notice that there's a really interesting reversal here. The boughs are shaking because of the wind. They're not shivering the way we do when we're trying to stay warm in the wind, but it looks like they are. That is, that what you get here is a typical of metaphor. So here's a really important definition of metaphor, or really important fact about metaphor. Elijah, you may appreciate the fact that the person who makes this argument most strongly is Donald Davidson. Metaphors are always false. That is definitional of a metaphor. If you say, my love is a rose that's newly sprung in June, It's totally BS. Love is an emotion that you feel in your mind. So metaphors are always false. A new metaphor, another way of putting it is to say that a new metaphor is something that an AI could not deal with. You know, if you look at AIs writing poetry or writing your papers for me or whatever, they are always using metaphors that have become in one way or another part of the linguistic record in the language. But a new metaphor is something that won't be processable in any literal sense. So metaphors, the difference, you know, in high school you're taught metaphors and similes are very similar to each other. You compare two things to each other and that's a simile. So if you say, my head feels like it's exploding, that's a simile because it's similar to what your head would feel like if it were exploding. Metaphor is my head is exploding. And one is true. What Davidson says, he's a philosopher who worked on lots of stuff in language. What he says is all similes are true because everything in the universe is in some way or other like everything else in the universe. So if you say something is like something else, that's always going to be true. This class is like Dancing with Fred Astaire. That's true, right? You all agree with that. But this class is Fred Astaire is false because it just isn't. So metaphors are always false. Similes are always true. And here, one way to think of the subtle falsity of this metaphor is not only are there no yellow leaves or none or few hanging from Shakespeare, not only can you not see a time of year in a person, oh, look, I think I see late May. It's just false. You don't have a late May birthday, do you?
No, it's November. Thing.
Yeah, okay. November what?
17th.
All right. Soon. You're almost, so you're on a cusp. You're no longer Scorpio, right?
No, I am a Scorpio.
Okay. I guess I don't remember when the cusps are. What comes after Scorpio? Don't you know your astrology?
Capricorn.
What is it?
Capricorn.
Is it Capricorn?
I'm Capricorn.
And when's your birthday?
End of December.
End of December.
No, Sagittarius comes between
right,
the two.
Yeah, which must come around November 18th.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so yeah, you're on the cusp. You're right between. You're right where you're about to be Sagittarius. That's called the cusp. It's a metaphor. Cusp there. Okay, so you can't really see a time of year in a person, but it's a metaphor. And the metaphor then is one which gets extended. Just as the metaphor of love taking up its residence in my heart, that's a metaphor. Love isn't actually doing that. It's not in the heart, and it's not a residence, and love has not defeated me in battle, and love is not clad in the arms that he fought me with. None of that is true, but we understand its meaning. So that's the metaphor. So, and here, though, the boughs shaking against the cold, it's as though the trees are shivering to keep warm, whereas, in fact, it's the wind is causing the branches to sway. So cause and effect are being reversed here. Wind is causing branches to sway, but here in the metaphor, cause and effect are reversed. Bare ruined choirs were late the sweet birds sang. So not long ago, there was a choir of birds on those boughs. Now they're leafless, they're shaking, all the birds have gone south. So that's the time of year that you see in me. But the yellow leaves are none or few makes it particularly visual. And that is a thing to notice. That was Craig, right? Yeah, that is particularly visual. If your name is Shakespeare, you're always going to notice when you use the word shake. Also when you use the word spear, but maybe less so. But it's always interesting reading Shakespeare. If he uses the word shake, he should notice it. Anyone read Romeo and Juliet?
Yeah.
Do you remember the word shake in that? The nurse says, "Shake, quoth the dove house," and she's describing an earthquake. There's actually a play where someone says, "Do you shake your spear at me?" Which is pretty funny. It's also the case that Shakespeare is the only person, only contemporary, who's named in the King James translation of the Bible. Lancelot Andrews, who was the chief translator and who knew Shakespeare, puts in an Easter egg for him, which is, I think it's the 44th Psalm. Andrews, who's translating it, the 44th word of the 44th Psalm, which was published on Shakespeare's 44th birthday. The 44th word is shake, and the 44th word from the end is
spear.
So there's a little Easter egg for Shakespeare in the King James Version of the Bible. Second quatrain, I didn't lay it out in quatrains because I was saving space, but the second quatrain, and Shakespeare didn't lay it out in quatrains too. You can see it from the rhyme. So first quatrain is "Behold, hang, cold, sang." Second one is "Day, west, away, rest. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away death's second self that seals up all in rest." So, what were you saying about the coming of winter?
I mean, it's like death, like when winter comes, that's like, it would fall, I guess, at the beginning, but winter is like the end, everybody dies, so.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think it is like death, but it's kind of more like sleep because the things come back. So that's maybe why it's like, "By black night, I'll take away death's second self."
Uh huh.
Because it's not fully death because they come back. The leaves will come back.
Yeah.
But it's going to go to bed.
Okay, so if you were filming this, I think that's absolutely right. Are you going to say something?
I was going to say it's different from what he was saying at first.
Go on.
He's talking about the time of day now as a parallel to season, but they're sort of like similar in the sense that this fall to winter moment is sort of like the moment after sunset, like
yes,
the sun is setting.
Yes, exactly.
What do you mean by that?
Because, like, think about the year as just like the beginning is the start and the end of the year is the end.
Yeah.
And then the day, you have the beginning of the day,
yeah,
and the end of the day.
Yeah.
And sort of at the same time, on this like timeline, we see sort of like sunset and fall turning into winter.
Okay, I see. So like the endings are both like ending season.
Yeah, they match each other.
Okay. Yeah. So, which is Alexis? That's where you were getting the. Yeah. So the idea here might be something like: at first, you think they're parallel. That is, that it's late in the year. Stands at quatrain one. The metaphor is late in the year. Quatrain two, late in the day. But I think what you're seeing and what you're saying is that it's later in the day in quatrain two than it is in the year in quatrain one. Mm-hmm. That is, that let's say quatrain one gives you mid-November. Mm-hmm. Quatrain two is giving you something that's more like past twilight.
Yeah.
So quatrain one would be, metaphorically, would be the same thing as twilight, but it wouldn't even be that because you can see the yellow leaves because it's daytime in quatrain one. That's the really cool thing about it, is that quatrain one is giving you a daytime scene.
Yes.
When yellow leaves are none or few do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. Quatrain two is not giving you a daytime scene, it's giving you a scene at dusk. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west. No chance of seeing that there are few leaves when you thought there were none, which by and by black night doth take away. It's really coming. Death's second self that seals up all in rest. A poem that we didn't look at, didn't have time to look at, but I hope you read because of the 9 hours a week thing, was the Wordsworth poem, A Slumber Did My Spirit Seal. Did anyone read that? On the handout from, on the last handout. So I'll just recite it for you, or you can pull it up. But it's, Wordsworth is describing the death of a woman whom he didn't pay enough attention to when she was alive. He loved her, but didn't pay enough attention. It belongs to a series of poems called the Lucy Poems, which is about the death of Lucy. And it goes, a slumber did my spirit seal. I had no human fears. She seemed a thing that could not feel the touch of earthly years. No motion hath she now, no force. She neither hears nor sees, rolled round in earth's diurnal course with rocks and stones and trees. So I mention that here because in a way what Wordsworth is doing is rewriting Sonnet 73. You can see it in the word seal that seals up all in rest, and a slumber did my spirit seal. And Wordsworth is also reversing it. She's dead, but you can see the rocks and stones and trees, earth's diurnal course, earth's daily cycle, but she's gone forever. So we may talk about it again when we do the part of the syllabus, which is versions of poems, poems which are versions of each other. And this is partly introducing that. Okay, so second stanza is parallel but not to the first stanza. All three quatrains are going to be images, metaphors of lateness. But part of what's amazing about this, it's almost like a Christopher Nolan movie, is that as we progress through those metaphors of lateness, it gets later. And as we progress through those metaphors of lateness, the metaphors are describing shorter periods of time. So stanza one, a lifetime is compared to a year. Stanza two, it's compared to a
day.
So stanza one, it's compared to something 1/70th of its original size. Stanza two, that year is compared to 1/365th of its original size. Stanza three, in me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie. So it's not twilight. Now the fire is going out. You light a fire maybe because it's cold outside. And the fact that it's cold outside also makes you think maybe it's a little bit later in the year even than the bare, than those trees that shake against the cold. Now you light a fire. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie. What does that metaphor mean? How does a fire lie on the ashes of his youth? Yeah.
The wood that has already burned, it's turned to ashes, but the fire is still, like, flickering.
Flickering. It's embers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lying on the ashes of his youth. So that's all that's left are the embers or ashes. Lying on those ashes as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. So it's choking in the ashes of the wood that nourished the fire. So you can really see how late it is.
What is the metaphor of the wood kind of confused, though? I understand the ashes, but what was the wood that nourished the...
So the fire is, so you have a wood fire. The fire is burning the wood, so the wood is nourishing the fire. You know, when you talk about feeding a fire,
yep.
You put more wood on it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the wood is nourishing the fire, and the fire is burning brightly, and burning up the wood, and turning it to ashes, which are now choking the remains of the fire.
Okay, and is there a symbolic thing for the wood itself or not? Like, is there a... I see the symbolism of like youth in the ashes, but what is the symbolism of the wood itself? Like, what's fueling that?
What's fueling it, did you say?
Yes.
Such a good word. The wood is fueling it, fueling the fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, I understand what you're saying, and I think that that's actually a great question. And the answer is, anyone want to say why wood would be particularly interesting in this series of metaphors at the end? Yeah.
Because wood is from trees, and we started with the trees, so we're ending with the trees.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. So the boughs that shake against the cold have now become the seasoned wood, the aged wood, that is burning away.
Yeah.
So again, what's so cool about this is you have a series of metaphors, but they're in a kind of counterpoint where there's one series of parallel or near parallel meanings, but there's also a thread that weaves in a direction from stanza to stanza. So time of year, time of day, time of night, the wood in stanza one, the boughs that shake against the cold, now become the fire that become the fuel of the fire that's been burnt out. You could say the sunset in stanza two are like the embers in stanza three. So it's not that you get three relatively parallel metaphors, which is the your first approximation of this. You know, like I don't know. Trump is an asshole is metaphor number one. Trump is a piece of shit is metaphor number... Well, no, that's too close to an asshole. Trump is an asshole is metaphor number one. Trump is a fool is... that's actually a metaphor is metaphor number two. Trump is a reckless driver is metaphor number three. Fine. They all mean pretty much the same thing. But here the metaphors interact with each other. You could take them as three metaphors for the same thing, but they really interact with each other interestingly. And so we get those three quatrains where there is development, but there's also a kind of parallelism. And then we get the volta, which is like the volta in Went to the Sessions of Sweet Silent Thought, which is I think of you, and then all sorrows are restored. All losses are restored, sorrows end. It's this thou perceivest. You see all this. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong. You must really love me when you see what a dilapidated person I am to love that well which thou must leave ere long. And yet you still love me. That's fantastic. So just one more minute. What's the word leave picking up on?
Leaves.
Yes, when yellow leaves are none or few do hang. You have to leave something before too long. But this poem is about how Shakespeare has to leave something. He's about to die. But now he's saying to the young man, when you look at me, don't think, oh, look at that old fart, but think, guess what? Time passes really fast, and you're going to be old really soon too. So there's a really interesting moment where the turn is not, it's officially, it's so great that you love me when I'm old and you're young, but it is also probably a good idea because it's going to happen to you before you know it. So again, metaphors, rhyme scheme, volta, sonnets, conclusion. Okay, read, use your 9 hours to read these other sonnets for Thursday. See you then. Okay, bye everybody.
Bye.
You too.
It reminds me of the